Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This hour we focus on an important article in the current issue of The Atlantic, the December issue of the magazine. The Ally from Hell is the name of the piece. Pakistan lies. It hosted Osama bin Laden, knowingly or not. Its government is barely functional. It hates the democracy next door. It's home to both radical jihadists and a large and growing nuclear arsenal, which it fears the U.S. will seize. Its intelligence service sponsors terrorists who attack American troops. With a friend like this, who needs enemies? One of the co-authors of the piece, Mark Ambender, is our guest this hour of the program. Mark is the White House correspondent for National Journal Group. He also writes on intelligence and national security, is a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He's currently writing a book on the national security secrecy apparatus after 9/11. Phone calls always welcome. As you know, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. The article is the product of dozens of interviews over the course of 6 months, and it is a joint project of The Atlantic and the National Journal. And Mark, thank you very much for being with us. Hello, Mark.
Hello, it's my pleasure to be here.
All right, yeah. It's great to have you with us. It's a lengthy and very important piece, and I think we all ought to know a whole lot more about what's going on in Pakistan after I read it. Much of the world, you write, is anxious about the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, and for good reason. What are the reasons?
Well, for one, if you were to decide that there be a place in the world where you were going to place a nuclear arsenal of 100-plus nuclear weapons, including tactical nuclear weapons, which are easier to explode, you probably would not want to house it in the country that is the source, the stem, the wellspring of Islamic militancy. You would not want to house it in a country where there are frequent military coups, or in a country where Islamists quite frequently attack military bases, including bases that have connections to the nuclear weapon security establishment. And that's even without getting into any of our present circumstances. The country of Pakistan has fought, even before the nuclear era, in the 20th century, three wars with India, and of course India has nuclear weapons as well. And as we report in the piece, Pakistan is very keen on keeping the location of these weapons from Americans and from the Indians, which means that they're moving them around a lot, which makes a lot of people very, very nervous.
Do we know where they are? Do we have enough satellites in place so we can keep track of the movements?
We devote a fairly large amount of our intelligence resources in the region to tracking that sort of stuff. But we don't have a completely precise picture, and we don't have a bead on all of them. There's been, you know, rumors over the course of decades that the U.S. had perfected some sort of RFID chip where they were able to somehow tag all of the nuclear weapons and follow them, and that's simply not true. I would say that the U.S. has a pretty good idea of where most of Pakistan's nuclear weapons are, but not all of them. And even where the U.S. has a sense even when the U.S. has a sense of where these weapons are, it doesn't necessarily mean that if there's an incident, the U.S. will be in a position of doing something about it, of protecting these weapons from bad people who would get their hands on them. So even knowing where they are is not necessarily a foolproof mechanism against these weapons being used in ways that will destabilize the region and could cause significant amounts of disruption, not just over there, but, you know, to the U.S. as well.
You write that Pakistani leaders have argued forcefully that the country's nuclear weapons are secure. Do we have reason to believe those leaders? Who are those leaders?
The leaders of the civilian government tend not to be the leaders who are in control in Pakistan. The army is the main source of political power in Pakistan. And as we detail in the piece, what the army says is not always what is. But it is true that Pakistan spends a significant amount of time and a significant amount of money, including U.S. money, to beef up its SPD, and that's what they call its Strategic Planning Directorate, which is the organization primarily responsible for securing nuclear weapons and for maintaining the command and control systems that are used to launch and verify nuclear weapons. The officers who are part of that regiment are the best trained and the most highly screened officers in Pakistan. And that's something that the U.S. recognizes. And they have Pakistan has a very significant counterintelligence program designed primarily to make sure that Americans and Indians aren't spying so much on the nuclear program. But in the process, it also helps weed out what the Pakistanis themselves, not what I, but Pakistanis themselves call the beards, the potential for militants. They're, you know, the people who are influenced by clerics with beards. I think that's where the term comes from in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It seems sort of crude from our purposes, but that's what they're looking for. And they've been fairly successful at that. And their record of success, they'll say, look, since 1998, we've had nuclear weapons. There have been times when people have attacked military bases, but no one has ever come close to taking a nuke or to acquiring any of our fissile material. And so far as Jeff Goldberg and I can tell, that's a correct assertion. So Pakistan, when it says our weapons are safe, can simply point to history. And there is something to that.
And yet you also in the article point to at least six facilities associated with their nuclear program have already been targeted by militants. These, of course, made news in this country, but please remind us of some of those.
Right. Well, in May, for example, at the Mehran Naval Air Base, which is a major Pakistani facility near Karachi, the base was held for more than a dozen hours by militants. And in fact, it took both U.S. and Chinese intervention to clear that base of Pakistani Taliban militants who had taken it over. In 2009, there was a suicide bomb outside a research laboratory where scientists who work to enrich uranium were leaving in a secure bus. I mean, these are just, you know, these are two examples. And all of these have been widely publicized. In 2007, there was an attack near an airbase that the U.S. believes probably stores ballistic missiles that would be mated with nuclear weapons in the event of a war. So there are certainly events that give analysts pause about the overall security of Pakistan's military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
But as to the weapons themselves, it isn't entirely clear, in part because we just don't know where all of them are. It isn't entirely clear whether any of these attacks or other attacks have come close. To the best of the U.S. intelligence community's knowledge, they haven't, and Pakistan asserts certainly that they haven't. And unfortunately, absent better information, the U.S. has to rely on its own aggressive intelligence gathering and the word of the Pakistanis.
And do the Pakistanis have concerns about this jihadist threat?
They do, but what they say is there's only so much that they can do to counter the threat without putting the stability of the entire country in danger. It's an interesting catch-22, because the more they do to counter the threat, the more they do to, in some ways, pulse up the threat. To, in some sense, their aggressive action against some of these militant groups creates more militancy. But of course, if they ignore it, the militants could take over. So what they say is they have to maintain a balance. And one of the main reasons for that is because many of these militant groups are helpful to them in Afghanistan. Pakistan doesn't want India to exert any influence in Afghanistan. It wants a stable Afghanistan. And these militant groups, in some sense, they're not helping to stabilize Afghanistan by attacking U.S. troops, which they do. So Pakistan essentially believes that the more that its central government allies with those who are going to have some power in Afghanistan going forward, it looks like the Afghan Taliban is going to be part of any coherent country in the future. I mean, we read today about ongoing peace talks between the Afghan Taliban and the Karzai government and the and ISAF. Pakistan has to choose its side, and what they'll say to the U.S. is, well, you guys are leaving. So does it make sense to you that we would ally with a group we think is going to be in power in Pakistan? And from their perspective, it's in their national interest to do so, even if those groups are also linked to militants that are fighting inside Pakistan. So it's a very difficult situation from their perspective. Sitting here in the United States, we could argue, well, they could do a lot more. And, you know, they have to recognize that all terrorists are terrorists. They're no good terrorists or bad terrorists. But from their perspective, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about their concern and tell me if it's the United States of more concern than jihadist elements in Pakistan. You talk about their concerns that, particularly after the Osama bin Laden raid, the U.S. has developed the technical means to stage simultaneous raids on Pakistan's nuclear facilities. Are there people in the government and in the army in Pakistan who actually believe that that's what we're planning on doing?
Not only do they believe it, in some ways it drives their policy toward the U.S. They're very, very, very concerned that the U.S. is simply going to come in one day and steal or try to steal their nuclear arsenal. So they're absolutely concerned about that. Should they be concerned about that? Well, in one sense, yes, because the U.S. does have plans. It has contingency plans in the event that there is a coup and that there is a very pro-Islamic, non-secular government that takes control. But the policy of the U.S. is not and has never been to deny Pakistan its nuclear arsenal. The policy of the U.S. is to maintain the civilian/secular army control over that arsenal. And that distinction often is lost on the Pakistani government. Quite frankly, it is also a way of ginning up anti-American sentiment to say, as they frequently do in the press, that the U.S. wants to come in and steal our nuclear weapons. And U.S. bashing is always a very easy and convenient way to build support for a cause.
Sure. Pakistan, yeah, that happens all over the world.
It does. In Pakistan in particular, though, believes that the U.S. constantly abandons it. When the U.S. needs something, it'll go to Pakistan, it'll get something. And then when Pakistan needs something, it almost always is done in reference to whatever India needs. And that makes Pakistanis themselves very, very angry.
What are our contingency plans should there be a coup?
Jeff and I were able to learn a bit about some of them. We decided not to include a number of details because we don't necessarily think it's a good thing to give that information away. But broadly speaking, the contingency plans would essentially, depending on what happened, let's say that there was a weapons convoy and it was attacked and a bunch of fissile material was stolen or a warhead was stolen. The response to that would be much different than if the U.S. attempted what's called a disablement mission, which is essentially a full-scale invasion of the country using Marines, using special operations forces, including the type of very special forces that killed Osama bin Laden, using the 20th Combat Support Command from the Army, which is trained specifically to render safe nuclear weapons. But you think about how difficult this would be. You have 100 nuclear weapons spread out across at least a dozen, if not more, storage sites, which are heavily guarded and protected by Pakistani troops who are not going to necessarily step aside for the Americans to come in. And it really becomes a question of, can the U.S. actually do this? And the conclusion that Jeff and I come to based on our interviews with people who are involved in planning for it is that probably not, even if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. It's probably something we couldn't do, even if we would not be able to take control of every nuclear weapon or everything that could become a nuclear weapon, i.e. fissile material and a warhead, not a nuclear weapon until you made it together. Just something that the U.S. doesn't have the capability to do because it would require an invasion force of 60 to 70,000 troops. I mean, in theory, you could muster up those troops, but it just isn't. It's one of those contingency scenarios which, you know, exists on paper in the Pentagon, in a deep vault in the National Military Command Center, and is occasionally exercised, but in reality is probably very far-fetched. Mm-hmm. In the movies, you can write a script that'll do it really nicely, and, you know, I can help write that script. But in reality, it's very hard to do, mm-hmm. which means that the U.S. has extra reason to be concerned about the safety and security of its nukes, about the stability of Pakistan's government, about how Pakistan moves its nuclear weapons around, particularly to foil the designs of India and or the United States, because the U.S. contingency plan is not necessarily a real contingency plan.
Mm. Oh, there's so much to this story, isn't there?
Oh,
yeah.
It's
so much.
It's fascinating and scary,
yes,
at the same time.
Yeah. Mark Ambender is our guest, and he is White House correspondent for the National Journal Group. We're talking about the piece that he co-wrote that's in the December issue of The Atlantic that is titled The Ally from Hell. It refers to Pakistan. Our number is 800-486-8655. Should you care to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. The email address, feel free to use that if you'd like, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Mark Ambender is our guest. Mark, I want to explore a little bit more this anti-American feeling because it's These numbers are huge. There was a Pew poll that you cite in your article taken after the Abbottabad raid that found that 69% of Pakistanis view this country, our country, as more of an enemy. Only 6% see the U.S. as more of a partner. This is after we got Osama bin Laden. What does that say?
You know, it says that, obviously, it says that we're not very popular in Pakistan, but of course, that's just a restatement of the poll. But there are reasons for that that are not necessarily irrational. If you look through the history of the way that the U.S. interacts with Pakistan versus the way that the U.S. interacts with India, you will see Pakistan constantly playing the junior partner in that triangular relationship. And, of course, Pakistan and India have been you know, in sort of a simmering Cold War for decades. The Pakistani people believe that the U.S. has not paid them the appropriate respect for all of the tens of thousands of Pakistani soldiers who have been killed in fighting al-Qaeda over the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. believe, the Pakistani people believe, for example, that the U.S., talks a lot about helping Pakistan's economy and growing its civil society, but won't actually do anything to further that end. One brief example that I found interesting was that there's a very thriving Pakistani textile market that finds it very difficult to enter U.S. markets because of various fairly protectionist policies on behalf that are on behalf of you know, textile interests here in the U.S. and North Carolina and elsewhere. I sort of believe that, again, so the U.S. will promise and say all these wonderful things about how we're going to help Pakistan, we're going to help Pakistan rebuild after earthquakes and floods. But when it comes down to actually doing things, the pattern, as Pakistanis see it, is either Pakistan will always play a subordinate role to the U.S.'s relationship with India, and the U.S. is constantly disrespectful to Pakistan's legitimate interests, and as well as what actually happens in the country. I mean, 25,000 Pakistani troops have been killed fighting al-Qaeda since the beginning of the, you could say, the beginning of the war against terror right after 9/11. That's far more troops than have been killed fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, mm-hmm. U.S. troops. And those, again, are not illegitimate concerns. There is, of course, as well, a general mistrust of America that's brought upon by U.S. policy toward Israel, and there's some anti-Semitism that's mixed into that. But built on top of that are these specific complaints that could be addressed by the U.S., but the U.S. will address them secondarily to what it thinks is its core interest in Pakistan, which is attacking al-Qaeda core, the core group of al-Qaeda operatives who planned the 9/11 attacks and who are directing other attacks around the world.
Yeah. And give me a sense, this is kind of a broad, too broad question, but take it in terms of what was happening with the press or on the street or with the civilian government or the military or whatever, the reaction to the killing of Osama bin Laden, to the raid.
Embarrassment. Generally, just Pakistani people embarrassed about the fact that he was living in their own country, the fact that the army, he was right under the nose of the army, he was living in a garrison town, and the army either didn't know about it or was harboring it. It was but more so than those two issues, the fact that the U.S. was able to sneak across Pakistan's border undetected, and perform the raid without Pakistan's knowledge, which was just highly embarrassing. And the army in Pakistan almost revolted against its commanders. That's how embarrassed they were about that event. It was just highly, highly, highly embarrassing to a country whose national pride is very fragile.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Cody in Oshkosh. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I was wondering what China's interest is there. I found it interesting that you said that U.S. and China work together to defend one of these attacks on a Pakistani base. Usually I think of Russia and China always being against us in this paranoia. Do they have legitimate reasons to be against us? And aren't they afraid of a nuclear bomb going off right next to them? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, I mean, look, China borders Pakistan, so it's going to have an interest in Pakistan. It has an interest in making sure that militancy inside Pakistan doesn't cross the border. China, of course, is very concerned about its Uyghur population in the western part of that very large country, and has seen evidence, indeed, that there is exchange between groups in Pakistan like Lashkar-e-Taiba and some of the Chinese Uyghur groups in China. And that just makes China very sensitive to the militancy issue in a way that some other countries might not be. And in the case of this naval base, there were Chinese workers who were on the base. That's one thing to realize is, number one, China provided Pakistan with a significant portion of its nuclear technology, has also provided Pakistan, as has the U.S., with significant military aid. But there are also an enormous number of Chinese workers inside the country. And so China feels that it has a significant, and this is beyond just economic exchange between the two countries, China feels that it has a significant role to play in helping India figure out, helping Pakistan figure out how to navigate these very thorny waters.
What are those Chinese workers doing?
Many of them are working on armament projects. Oh. A lot of them are also working on you know, for example, mineral mining throughout the country, as there are many Chinese workers in Afghanistan doing the same thing, all of which, you know, mutually benefit both countries. But China tends to be fairly voracious in seeing Pakistan as a source of natural minerals, and you know, and there are a lot of Chinese workers spread throughout throughout the country in both the military construction establishment as well as the sort of the, you know, the basic material, the basic metal, the basic mineral establishment, which of course is, you know, needed for everything that a country does, from food to housing to, you know, to military to communications.
Thank you, Cody. Our number is 800-486-8655. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Yeah, I agree that you need to stabilize that country over there. It's all about resources. The average Pakistani have enough resources to live a decent life. And then once you do that, you also need to work on some of the radical religion. Any religion that, you know, if the, their concept of God does not really enshrine the truth, freedom, and love principles, and they get, you know, kind of totalitarian or whatever, you know, that's the problem, too. So if we could moderate some of the religion and, like I said, bring the standard of living up, that would really help, you know, I think, our interest in that whole area.
Mark?
That's certainly true. Most USAID now goes toward the Pakistani military, and there have been some efforts by U.S. policymakers to divert it or to make sure at least to a greater degree than it does that it goes to civilian projects, even, for example, civilian law enforcement agencies, but it's been very difficult for that to happen. But no, it's certainly true. I mean, if the last thing that the U.S. wants is for Pakistan to be a failed state. And it certainly isn't, but there are parts of the country, because of recent earthquakes and floods, where, you know, the sense of desperation among Pakistani people and dislocation is intense. And that generates not just anti-U.S. feeling, but just a, you know, general instability that if you are a militant group, you can take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the need for the United States to remain engaged with the Pakistani government. We must be able to receive information from the ISI about Al-Qaeda and also keep watch over the nuclear program. Can you give us a sense of how engaged we are with the Pakistani government? With whom are we engaged, and are we receiving that vital information about Al-Qaeda?
We tend to be engaged with the Pakistani government at its highest levels. The head of the ISI, General Pasha, the head of the Army, General Kayani. Their Department of Energy liaises very directly with the head of the Strategic Planning Directorate. The civilian government under Prime Minister President Zardari is much weaker than the Army, although the U.S. does engage with the civilian government. That has much less effect on policy, and when something needs to happen, the U.S. will generally call the Army. And even though you read constantly in the press about the failings of U.S. diplomacy and how U.S. official will read the Riot Act to a Pakistani official, the lines of communication are always open. And on some issues, particularly the nuclear issue, because Pakistan itself is so sensitive to that issue, if the U.S. says, you know, we're concerned about this, we're concerned about that, Pakistan tends to address it. On other issues, it's very difficult. I mean, after, for example, a major earthquake in 2005, the U.S. wanted to send significant amounts of aid and aid workers to the country, but Pakistan's government refused because they believed that the U.S. would use the visas that would be provided to them to send in spies. Pakistan was probably correct in that assumption, but that complicated and sort of, you know, broke ties between certain parts of our government and their government for a long time. But for the most part, the U.S. and Pakistan are in fairly constant contact, even if there isn't a relationship of trust. I guess the issue that both Jeff and I found, though, is that we tend to trust Pakistan we tend to take their word, or we have, or policymakers do. They tend to take, you know, somebody the word of a general that they've known for a long time, and then they tend to get shocked when it turns out that general hasn't been telling them the full truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we take those types of interactions in the U.S. very, very seriously. If somebody says to your face that something is X, you're going to believe that something is X, particularly if you've had a relationship with them. But in Pakistan, that's simply not the most convenient or effective way to do business or advance their national interests. And we have to accept that, to some degree, yelling at Pakistan about not doing enough to put down militants in certain parts of the country, in North Waziristan, for example, and listening to them promise that they will and then being shocked when they won't, it's kind of old by now, because that's what Pakistan does. There's just so much that they can do and so much that they can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're willing to do. And so the U.S. has to simply come up with a different policy toward these militant groups and not worry so much about what Pakistan says or doesn't say.
Yeah. And tell me more about these militant groups. Are their numbers growing?
I mean, the militant groups in some ways are a creation of the Mujahideen's war against the Russians in Afghanistan, which, of course, the U.S. supported quite heavily. And in some ways outsourced to Pakistani militant groups, creating these groups in many ways. And when that war was successful, both the U.S. and the Pakistanis didn't see to the dismantlement of those groups. They kind of left those groups alone. And in that vacuum, the groups grew. And then Pakistan began to use them, and there are many different groups, but just in general, Pakistan began to use them as sort of proxies against India, and began to recruit heavily, help these groups recruit heavily in the Kashmir region and train them in Afghanistan. One of the ironies, of course, of the marriage between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is that it was facilitated by the Pakistanis in order to provide, in theory, another source of recruits to fight India. So Pakistan has been, for the lack of a better phrase, in bed with many of these militant groups for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
It has also reaped what it has sown, in the sense that the Pakistani Taliban, in particular PTT, has turned into an internal security problem for Pakistan, and in some ways is waging war against the Pakistani government. Not surprising from our perspective, because, of course, they're a militant group. That's what militant groups tend to do. But, you know, Pakistan's preferred strategy has been to facilitate these groups' expansion, but direct their energy in areas, sort of outsource foreign policy to them in many ways, direct their energy, as I was, you know, mentioning earlier, whether it comes to Afghanistan, whether it involves India, outsource their foreign policy using these militant groups. Militant groups, for the most part, are happy to receive the assistance, but, you know, they aren't owned by the government of Pakistan, and they have their own agendas, and their agendas don't always overline or overlap with that of the government, and increasingly they won't, and increasingly they aren't, and that's, again, going to be a problem that Pakistan is going to have to deal with in the future. It's going
mm-hmm.
to have to deal with a growing internal security threat from militant groups it cannot control.
Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. You know, all this talk about Pakistan for some time has really concerned me, because everything we seem to hear about Pakistan are things like you've been talking about, how untrustworthy they are and how they deal with militants and so forth and so on. But one issue that I don't seem to hear a lot of discussion about is our general trade policies in this country. For example, if you go into some of the major department stores, you know, it can be Target or Kohl's, it doesn't matter. It doesn't take you very long to look through the shirts and the pants and see all this stuff that we are buying from Pakistan. And I'm wondering why we are doing that if Pakistan seems to be such a marginal country. It seems to me we should be using our economic clout to say, well, you know, if you're going to hide terrorists or support terrorist groups, we're not going to trade with you. Why don't we use that more as a tool?
The carrot and stick approach in general, which the U.S. has tried, just doesn't work. Pakistan is not going to essentially base its policy on militants around what the U.S. says. It does not matter to them. It just doesn't. So we can pretend that it does, pretend that what the U.S. is, what the U.S. wants and thinks along these lines matters significantly, or we can go after the militants ourselves, which is what we appear to be doing now, and work with Pakistan, Pakistan's government on the issues of mutual concern to us both that Pakistan's government can actually do something about. Pakistan has its own relationship with the Haqqani network, with the Pakistani Taliban, with Lashkar-e-Taiba, and with militants in the Baluchistan province, which have always wanted independence from the country of Pakistan. I mean, our pressure on Pakistan, if we were trying to somehow use I'm not really sure what you would call it, because we don't have too much trade with Pakistan now. We have some, but not too much. If we were to try and use that leverage somehow to force the Pakistani government to deal differently with militants, it wouldn't work. It's one of these mismatches that we sort of talk about. Again, we're seeing it through our eyes and not through their eyes. Weirdly enough, Pakistan would probably much rather the U.S. go after militants by ourselves, even in sovereign Pakistani territory right across the Durand line, which separates Afghanistan from Pakistan, than us constantly haranguing the Pakistani government to do it themselves. And in fact, that's what we do. That's what the U.S. policy has been secretly for the past couple of years. We have deferred to Pakistan, though, in not doing it as often as we should do, because we've believed Pakistan's assurances that they were going to go after the militants. And they don't, and they didn't. So one of the things that we recommend in the piece is, if we believe it's in our interest to prevent the Haqqani network, for example, from facilitating a bomb factory that will be used to supply the Afghan Taliban so that they can, you know, blow up U.S. tanks, the U.S. or ISAF should take out that bomb factory. We shouldn't rely on Pakistan to do it, because Pakistan will not do it.
And what about the deal we had then with, I keep going back to Osama bin Laden, but it was a fairly big deal. Did we have an unwritten agreement, or maybe even a verbal agreement, that we would take care of that?
No, I don't think so at all. I think the U.S., I mean, I think U.S. policy was vis-a-vis Pakistan, if Pakistan were to figure out or to find out where he was, U.S. strongly hoped that they would identify to the U.S. or give the U.S. information about it, and the U.S. and Pakistan would at that point jointly do something. But when the U.S. unilaterally developed intelligence on Osama bin Laden, it was decided fairly early on that there was just no way to trust the Pakistanis with that information. And you know, look, President Obama, when he was running, this was in August of 2007, fairly memorably, because he was criticized for it at the time, said that if Pakistan refuses to kill a terrorist that's on its soil or is harboring a terrorist, the U.S. will have no compunction about going in and even invading the country's sovereign territory, which it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it will, and it has done. One thing we've tried to get across in the piece is that it has done so many times to go after terrorists, usually right across the border, not entirely across the country. About as much closer to India's border than it is to Afghanistan's border. But you know, for all intents and purposes, there has been in some ways a simmering Cold War between the U.S. And these militants inside Pakistan for the past several years as well.
More phone calls momentarily and emails. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Mark Ambender is our guest, the White House correspondent for National Journal Group. He writes on intelligence and national security, is a contributing editor at The Atlantic, and we're talking about the current piece, which is in the December issue of Atlantic on the Ally from Hell. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls. Sharon in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I just was thinking about how the Ally from Hell could be us in terms of looking at it from the Pakistani perspective. I was really disappointed this summer. The last 2 years, they had huge floods in Pakistan, and hardly any of that was focused on in the U.S., and I kept thinking this is a perfect opportunity for us to get some brownie points if we had the help from the soldiers that we've got right in that vicinity helping these poor people who had nothing, and they were hanging from trees because of the water. And I just really felt that that was an opportunity kind of lost. We could be shown in not just, you know, the Ally from Hell, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Both Jeff and I think that you're right. There's a lot that the U.S. can do that has nothing to do with military aid, that has nothing to do with yelling and hectoring Pakistan. That would make a significant difference in how the Pakistani people view the U.S., which would make a significant difference in how the Army deals with the U.S., because the Army derives its power from the fact that the Pakistani people admire it.
And thank you very much, Sharon, for the call. An email from Jeff in Milwaukee. Could you address the white elephant in this situation? Since the current Pakistani government was at considerable threat of collapse due to the Taliban militant force in the western Pashtun region, it was in the Pakistanis' best interest to keep Osama bin Laden safe and sound close to Islamabad, leaving their opposition in the border region open to attack from U.S. forces and drone strikes, of course.
It's an interesting theory that I don't think has a basis in fact. The Pakistani government, virtually every element of it, would have every reason to take out Osama bin Laden. I've heard a couple of different theories on this, but realistically, they would have every reason to want to find him and take him out themselves.
Mm-hmm.
At least so far as when it comes to its joint interest with the U.S. There may well have been people within the Army and ISI establishment who knew where he was, but there's no evidence, nor is there a really plausible scenario at this point to suggest that the senior decision makers in the Army or the intelligence establishment were aware that he was living, you know, again, in their equivalent of West Point.
Kelly in River Falls, hi.
Yeah, I had read some works by Howard Zinn and then went back and looked at some New York Times articles back in 2001. And isn't it true that the Taliban offered to put Osama bin Laden on trial before we started bombing, and that 10 days into the bombing, they offered to send him to a third country to be put on trial? That's what the New York Times reported, and I'm wondering if your guests could speak to that, please.
I have no idea. I don't know. There are enormous number of reports about the struggle within the Taliban between the U.S. and elements of what are now the Afghan government in Pakistan in the days after September 11th, trying to figure out where everyone stood on different on a variety of different issues. But so far as I've heard something like what your caller says, but it's beyond my level of knowledge. If that were true, certainly that would be a major failure on behalf of U.S. to take those terms. You know, I guess the implication being the U.S. wanted war, but I would tend to doubt it just based on common sense. But stranger things have happened.
Right.
Incredibly, incredibly complicated region.
Yeah.
And you never necessarily know who your friends are, who your enemies are at all times. So.
Thanks, Kelly. Raj in Madison. Hi, Raj.
Oh, good morning. I'm calling about a broader issue. The question is, you know, okay, why do these people hate us? One of the things that we tend to forget are people that people in that part of the world live in tribal cultures where the different tribes have different languages. I was born and raised in Palestine when it was under British rule. And I lived in Cairo when it was under British rule. And then I came to this country as a young boy, as a refugee in 1952. And the reality is, in that part of the world, the Americans are perceived as part of the English-speaking tribe. And there is an animus towards all English-speaking people, all people who are of English-speaking origin, and that I think has persisted in no matter where you go, and there is nothing we can do about it except perhaps be more aware of it. It is true there are a lot of issues that influence the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, but Pakistan really is a nation state made up of tribes that speak different languages. And the minute we speak English, hey, if that is your native language, then you're part of the enemy.
Mark, your response.
I think the caller is exactly right. If you look at the way that Pakistan was founded, even the name Pakistan is not a name that's indigenous to the country, but it's a name that was sort of foisted upon the country. The boundaries of the country, the regions of the country were drawn by, in many ways, British imperialists. You know, and one irony is, you know, Abbottabad, town where Osama bin Laden was located, is named after a British regent. And, you know, that the caller just makes a very good point about one long-standing tension that underlies the relationship here, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what did you come away with as a result of this extensive reporting over 6 months? Are you incredibly fearful of Pakistan, or do you think that, something good will happen, our relationship with that country will develop for the good?
We hope that U.S. policymakers will begin, or not begin because many of them are, but continue to take a more mature and differentiated look at the way it relates with that country, and is very sensitive, particularly to the language that U.S. officials, when they are over in Pakistan, use to describe the relationship. But we also felt that the U.S. government has been and talking to the American people about Pakistan under some sort of under an illusion or a series of illusions. One of which was that Pakistan is really an ally, and it's not an ally in the conventional sense that we think of as an ally. You know, it's very hard to talk to the mother of a soldier who was killed by a bomb that was placed there by some group that was financed by, you know, Pakistani ISI, that the U.S. has to be constantly, has to maintain ties to Pakistan. But that's the reality of it. That's why, again, it represents to us an ally from hell. But it's an ally that, so long as Pakistan has its nuclear weapons, so long as other Muslim countries will look to Pakistan. If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, everyone will go to Pakistan and want the same thing from Pakistan. So the U.S. has to have some degree of influence over Pakistan. We have to be there. And there are things we can do that we're not doing to make things better for us. And there are things we sh- shouldn't be doing that we are doing that are constantly, like, repeatedly slamming your head against a door. It just will hurt you, and it, you know, won't get you through the door.
Yeah. Those nuclear weapons change everything, don't they? They make it so much more frightening.
They certainly do. I mean, they make, in a sense, what would be a manageable threat into an existential threat.
Yeah.
And that's why...
Well put.
That's why we're there.
Thank you very much, Mark, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Ambender, co-author of a piece that is in the current issue of The Atlantic, that is the current, meaning December of 2011, The Ally from Hell. It's about Pakistan. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your interest, your calls, your emails. We'll be with you again tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, so I hope you will be with us then. Great conversations ahead. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.